The title of this conference by Father John Hardin is Christianity as Community. Father Hardin, a member of the Society of Jesus, is professor of systematic theology at the Bellarmine School of Theology, Loyola University, Chicago, Illinois. He is author of many books and articles published in the United States, Canada, and Europe. His latest book is Christianity in the 20th Century. Father Hardin is a lecturer and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises. He is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. Father Hardin has been a consultant to the consortium from its beginning and is closely associated with its interests as a communication enterprise for religious women in the United States. Father Hardin.
Perhaps never before in its history has the world been more socially conscious. We have, first of all, the evidence of a whole bevy of new sciences that have come into being, some within the last generation. Sociology covers, as you know, an almost infinite variety of branches. Social statistics, social ethics, social psychology, social planning, social geography, social history, economics. And so the list could go on, all symptomatic of the kind of preoccupation in the modern world. It is, if anything, a deeply social concern. Again, in the Roman Catholic Church, I don't believe there has been a single subject on which modern popes have written and spoken at greater length and more incisively than on the social responsibility of Christians. Rerum Novarum of Leo XIII, Quadragesimo Anno of Pius XI, Mater in Magistra of John the 23rd, several documents of Paul the 6th. The longest and in many ways the most comprehensive of the 16 documents of the Second Vatican Council is the one on the Church in the modern world. Its whole focus, practically its theme, is the church in the modern world is a church that has got to be very socially sensitive and responsive. Once again, we're just trying to get perspective. The greatest scourge of Christianity since the apostolic age, without a doubt, has given us already more martyrs than all the 300 years of the Roman persecutions. Masks under the title of communism. Those first two syllables are not coincidental. And it's phenomenal, as I don't hesitate saying, diabolical success is at least partly due to the fact that it has exploited the failures of Christians in nominally Christian cultures like our own to live up to the ethical demands of the gospel, which are nothing, those demands, if not essentially communal in character. You cannot read the 25th chapter of Matthew's Gospel and not take the needs of others seriously when, as Christ foretold, it will be on the basis of our having satisfied those needs that we and the rest of the world will be saved. Among the books that Bishop Sheen wrote, one that I think is well worth rereading is called Communism and the Conscience of the West. What he says, in effect, is communism is on the conscience of the West. Christianity, which ought to be a communion, has had some of its finest principles stolen and perverted by communism. Among the people in my boyhood days that I came to know, and one that I will always remember, is a family that lived with us in two small furnished rooms that Mother and I used to let out. This family had a father who was a card-carrying communist, a Catholic wife, and there is another story which I may tell in its place about their little daughter, Jean, that I stood as godfather for when she was baptized, but now the communist father. I was a kid at the time they lived with us. I was asked to be godfather years later. But the dedication of that communist, as he said, "I want to spend my life working for the underdog." I suppose I was about 10 years old at the time, maybe 10 to 12, if they live with us about 2 years. He edified me, and I haven't been the same since. It was kind of hard on the family. But you know, he used to be a communist agitator. He belonged to a union that would send him to some shop or factory, and in a couple of weeks, there would be trouble, naturally, because he started it, to get the management into difficulties. Then they would fire him after a couple of months. In the meantime, he might spend a month in jail. And always, his one idea was to help the underdog. To refresh my memory, I reread the paragraph on religious poverty, about which more anon, in Pope Paul's latest exhortation to religious, pleading with us to be sensitive to the needs of the world, whatever their faults and their crimes, and they are many. Let's give the devil his due. Communists are sensitive to people's needs. In the process, they may kill other millions. Well, that's part of the mythology. All I want to say at this point is that our religious life today is being lived in an age in which the hydra of communism is on the conscience of us all. Fourth observation, still by way of perspective. The rapid shrinking of the globe, thanks to rapid transportation and almost instant electronics communication, is both a warning and a challenge to us Christians this world, in one sense, is as big as it was a century ago. Geographically, no change in size. But psychologically, it is getting smaller and smaller every year. And part of the problem of a large part of this world is precisely that it is in such desperate need. Most of the world tonight, whenever that night is, in whatever part of the world we might think about, will go to bed hungry. A lot of Americans have to take a variety of, you name them, to fall asleep because they have eaten too much. These hungry millions know about us, well-fed millions. It's a warning. Consequently, it behooves us to learn about our communal responsibility. It means, furthermore, this shrinking of the globe, that we should courageously live up to this responsibility ourselves, and that we are to help Christianize the world, which can be, as you know, a very flabby, it's a verb, isn't it, Christianize? A very flabby verb. You name it. Unitarian uses it, means one thing. The Pope uses it, it means something else. Well, among the things that Christianization means is that in our apostolate, we make the people who come under our care conscious, painfully conscious. Read at them those devastating words of James. Talk about revelation being outspoken. Makes your spine tingle. You rich, this is James, unless you share your wealth, you will burn in fire and howl like dogs. In other words, that part of our responsibility is being conscious of the fact that Christianity is essentially communitarian. I'm giving myself plenty of time to cultivate our communitarian responsibilities as religious. But remember, part of our apostolate is to evangelize. That means Christianize. And I hope the verb won't scandalize you. It ought to mean communize. And I don't mean teaching communism. Make people aware, shake them if need be, as James did, as Christ did, to their duties as Christians, who according to Christ are to form one worldwide community. Yet, look at us Christians. More wars in the last 100 years than in all the recorded history of mankind. So much for perspective. for this evening's and tomorrow's meditation, and I suggest for many tomorrows after, let us reflect on the subject that we've taken, Christianity as community. And for this meditation, instead of doing what we have been doing so far, suppose this time we just look at a series of truths of our faith. Briefly, there are too many of them, each shedding additional light on our one main subject, that Christianity is community. So now then, the analysis, any aspect of which I end up with seven, deserves a meditation and more. To begin to understand this profound subject of how Christianity is community, we've got to begin before the beginning of time, in eternity, and take our first look through the eyes of faith at the Trinity. God, as Christian faith tells us, is by his nature a divine society. That's right. His essence is that three persons, each distinct from the other, we know something about how distinct persons can be. We've lived with them. And are they ever distinctive? God's essence, therefore, is that three persons, each an individual. That's what constitutes a person. Eternally form one being by their mutual sharing of the divine nature. If that statement makes us drowsy, sisters, it is at the foundation of all human society. God, then, is a plurality, bound together by infinite love to form an indissoluble and surely, in our human language, ineffable unity. When, then, we begin to read the Bible in Genesis, and after man is brought into the world, we are told that God made man to his image and likeness. We may read those words, as we have been doing, correctly, by saying that that image and likeness is that we, unlike the rest of creation, which is either inanimate or animate indeed, but irrational, men, unlike all the rest, has a spirit, like to God's, that like God, being spiritual, we have minds and freedoms, which I prefer to mind and will. Correct. We have been made to the image and likeness of God, because like him we have been gifted, which, now this is a thought, not a fancy. God might have stopped anywhere along the line. He might have made us a lowly dandelion. Why not? That dandelion has no right to existence. Or he might have made us we smile. Squirrels. Why not? I like to watch them. All freely created by God. He didn't. He might have stopped anywhere short of giving us our humanity. However, that passage in Genesis, for the context in which we are looking, having been made to the image and likeness of God, believing as we do as Christians, and only the light of the Christian faith shining on Genesis can now tell us this. He has made us social beings, like God, who is the eternal triune society. And we are as more godlike as we are more responsive to this quintessential part of our humanity. What I have done is for each of these seven, I don't know why, it just occurred to me, I jotted in red a motto for each of these seven. Use it if you wish. The motto for number one, that's only as far as I've got so far, is Trinity. What are we talking about? To remind ourselves, Christianity is community. The second cameo observation. We are still in Genesis. This time we read about the call of Abraham. Let me read. Yahweh said to Abram, his name was later changed. Kind of symptomatic, isn't it? Listen to what follows. Leave your country, your family, and your father's house, for the land I will show you, I will make you a great nation. Unquote. Yahweh. This is the beginning of the chosen people, of whom Christianity is the spiritual descendant. But remember, Abraham was just one person. He was to become a nation, a people, a race, a multitude, bound together by their common call through Abraham and loyalty to Yahweh. My motto for reflection too is chosen people. Third, brief glance. As you see at this point, we could spend hours in the Old Testament. I might add, just as a bit of erudition, that I took a whole semester's course in Rome, a graduate course, on the chosen people. 3 classes a week, filled a whole notebook with notes. Now we open the New Testament. And the first pages tell us that God became man. Each of the evangelists approaches the subject in different ways, but it's clear God became man. But he didn't just become man. He was, and he chose to be, born into a family. It was not just Jesus. It was Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. Note, therefore, the communal nature of Christ's incarnation. He didn't have to do it this way. If he worked the astounding miracle of becoming man, he could have figured out all kinds of other ways of doing it. He didn't. It was familial. Even before his conception, it was at birth. And for years into Christ's early manhood. You know the motto for this one, Holy Family. After 30 silent years at Nazareth, Christ begins his public ministry. And look, being who he was, he might have done it in all kinds of other ways. He didn't need moral support, sisters. If he was looking for moral support, he went to the wrong place. Look what he did. He gathered around him the apostles. And except for loyal John, you'll pardon my saying so, they failed him. Well, they came back to their senses, minus one. But from the very beginning, he organized a group, a collectivity. What we're doing, therefore, I trust with divine help, is to bring out more and more clearly. Now, we'll get to the religious life in due time, but give us time. That from the beginning of Christ's public life, and you see we've got an ancestry here which goes back to eternity, he started a community. Each of the apostles was called personally. Their names, the evangelists remember. They reached the number 12, and then Christ stopped. Now, some smart exegetes say, well, he stopped because there were 12 tribes of Israel. Imagine Christ being limited by the 12 tribes of Israel. What a joke. There were 12 apostles because Christ wanted 12 apostles. And being God, he made sure there were 12 tribes of Israel. The motto for this is the apostles.
This conference is continued on Side B.